You're listening to the Embracing Grief podcast.
We're your hosts, Trish and Lori, two women on a journey of life after the passing of our spouses.
Our conversations are sparked by experiences and how we are creating the next chapters of our lives with our children, with our careers, and with our grief.
We are sharing real life situations and actions to keep moving forward with honor, belief, and connection to create a sense of community.
You are not alone. We are so grateful you're here. We're so excited to share with you an interview we did with Stephanie Sarazen. Stephanie's a writer, researcher, and experiential expert in ambiguous grief. Her work began with her own experience of midlife trauma, which sparked an ambitious journey spiritually and around the world to understand, name, and heal the grief she found within her. Her efforts reveal the first-of-its-kind definition for ambiguous grief, whereby grief is the onset of a loss of a loved one who is still living, and wherein the experience of hope presents as a stage of the grieving process. Stephanie's work brings new resources to reframe disruptive, activating events as gateway to discovering your highest self. Stephanie's also the founder of Rise Uprooted, an online resource center for navigating ambiguous grief, a grief educator and a TEDx curator in her community. She's a graduate of Michigan State University and earned her Master of Public Policy from the University of Chicago. She's an avid reader, recreational runner, aspiring camper, lives in North Carolina, where she is training to trek to the Mount Everest Base Camp. Her book, Soul Broken, A Guide for Your Journey Through Ambiguous Grief, is published by Balance, an imprint of Grand Central Publishing. It launched October 11th, 2022, and it's currently available at Barnes & Noble, Amazon, or your favorite independent bookseller. Trish and I hope you enjoy this interview as much as we did.
Well, hello.
Hi, Stephanie.
Hi.
My Trish.
Morning.
Good morning.
I'm sitting outside, so there's a little bit of background noise, so I apologize.
I've listened to many episodes and love your style and the way you care for one another, the way you are just present for each other. It's really, really lovely.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that.
You're welcome. You're welcome. I have a friend who is my daily correspondent. We live states and states away, and we met similarly to, I believe, how you two met in a group, didn't you? Right. So did she and I. And we talk almost daily since 2017. And she literally, she's traveling to India as of last night. And I'm like, do you have to go on this work trip? And can you get the international plan from Marco Polo so that we can, I don't know how we're going to do this if you can't reach out. So it's so important. It's just a lifeline.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think either of us realized it's once you have something, you didn't realize you were missing it before you had it, you know?
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's just been, it's funny because we only talked a couple of times before we started recording the podcast.
Really?
Yes. A handful, maybe.
Wow.
But there was just something about the way we left those conversations, the way we felt, that we were like, we're not the only people who are missing something like this. People are missing this feeling or could have this feeling. And so, we're just like, well, we'll just record the podcast and put it out there. And at first, it was like no big deal because we were like, no one will listen to this. We didn't even really tell anyone. We just kind of did it. And then we would just hear from people and be like, oh, listen to the podcast. It's beautiful. And we're just kind of
nice.
Like, really? You did?
Nice.
So it kind of just grew
nice,
very organically.
It's interesting because as you're saying that, I agree with all of it. And I'm reminded of, you know, in talking with others or being with others in their grief, it helps me still reflect on my own, you know, and something I found was that deciding to kind of embrace it and move with it sometimes can be scary for people because, and was scary for me at one time, and I didn't realize why, but it's because, you know, there's just kind of an unsaid feeling that you're leaving your love behind.
Right.
Right. And sometimes grief is the last thing we have to hold on to from that relationship, from that love. We think that it's not true, but it sure feels like it, you know, a lot of times. And so I think that can be a barrier that we as experiential experts who have had the experience, we can help others identify what that is and help them take that next step forward, because it isn't easy. And it sure would have been nice to have a hand to hold when I did it, you know, but maybe we can do that for others.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I think also, Trish, what you were kind of touching on is this idea of like with a death, there is what appears to be a very clear end of one thing, beginning of the next.
Mm-hmm.
Though it's not as clear once you've experienced it. Like there's a definite end of a physical relationship, but then there's all this other stuff kind of as you were describing. But Stephanie, what you look at is ambiguous grief, which is a little bit distant, and I'm not sure has the very clear defining moment where you don't have a choice. It's going to move in another direction, whether you like it or not. So if you could just speak on what is ambiguous grief.
Sure. You know, so ambiguous grief is new to me. I am, you know, kind of an accidental grief researcher. I found myself in an experience where I was in deep grief and couldn't find anybody to really help me through it. Anybody who had the experience themselves, they could help me through it. I certainly had terrific therapists, but for me, 6 years ago, I had discovered that my husband of 18 years was not indeed the deeply in love man I believed him to be. And, you know, quite on accident, found that he had been unfaithful for many years. And we divorced shortly thereafter. And for me, it was the death of my marriage. It came as a complete surprise. And I wasn't one of those, you know, spouses who kind of went, whew, glad I found a way out of that. I absolutely adored my husband and my marriage. And so, you know, with three confused kids and, you know, myself shaken, I didn't know what to do. And the first thing I really started doing was trying to find somebody to talk to, you know, and it was just, you know, there was plenty of information on divorce and plenty of information on, you know, betrayal, trauma, but we're kind of desensitized to it, I think, in our culture, you know, and it's, yeah, this sounds like a Lifetime movie and that's familiar. So it doesn't, unless you've had the experience, it's not something others really internalize. And why should they? You know, I don't slight anybody for that. I wouldn't have been able to. And so as I started kind of asking a few friends, do you know anybody who maybe dealt with affairs? And I should say, I didn't speak to anybody about this for 3 months, which is incredible to me looking back on it. But it was my own shame and my own embarrassment of what was happening, my own surprise. I didn't want to tell I told one trusted friend and my therapist. And those are the only two who knew the full truth. I didn't want to tell my family who lives, you know, we're out of state, and I didn't want to tell our mutual friends, and I didn't know what to say, right? But I'd kind of poke around and ask friends, hey, I have a friend going through some stuff. Do you know anybody who's And it was no. Nobody knew anybody. And so I was desperate to find my people and ultimately flew to Arizona for a 5-day workshop where I met just tremendous women going through the same experience. And we became friends and, you know, kind of held each other accountable and just supported each other through our grief. And getting to know other women in this situation helped me reflect on what I was experiencing. And I could see what they were experiencing, much as the two of you do for each other. And I found that our grief was different, you know? So I reached out to some authors of books I had read and, you know, talked to my therapist, really just digging online, you know, a lot, trying to figure out what about this was different. And ultimately, I discovered that, you know, there's something called ambiguous loss, which was the closest thing. And ambiguous loss, you've probably heard about, it was a term coined by Dr. Polly Voss back in the 90s. And she was a practitioner who observed, you know, really through her whole lifetime, but most recently in her clinical practice, individuals who were experiencing, you know, the loss of their loved one and, you know, kind of in an in-between state. And what I found she was studying when she coined this term were individuals whose loved ones had been, you know, MIA at war or lost in an unknown death due to a natural disaster or a kidnapping, you know, and the families are left kind of with this ambiguous loss and how do they move forward? And then later her work continued on Alzheimer's, you know, and where there's a physical presence, but a psychological absence. And these were really close to what I was experiencing because I'm grieving my marriage. I'm grieving my husband, but he's just a few miles away now. You know, we're divorced, but he has not passed on physically. And yet we have no relationship. And so how do I grieve that? And so I found Dr. Boss's work to be really close, but still quite not what I was looking for, which was, you know, my loss wasn't ambiguous. My grief was ambiguous. I did not know how to grieve somebody who is still alive. And as I started writing about it, partnered with a therapist who, working together, we did an assessment tool and a survey and found some interesting data that, you know, was what I had suspected, what she and I had suspected. And that is that grieving the loss of a loved one who is still living, though not as they once were, can, you know, be activated by a myriad of events that kind of put us in this process of ambiguous grief that has its own kind of subset of grief by physical death. And we have to figure out, you know, how to do it in a society that doesn't do physical death very well, right? So some of those activating events, not just divorce or a discovery like mine, but familial estrangement, Alzheimer's or cognitive decline, traumatic brain injury, a gender identity change, empty nesting, a mental health ailment, and addiction. Addiction was a really big one in our data, as well as indoctrination to like a gang or a religious cult of some sort, where our loved one is not physically dead, but they are, the relationship has changed or is broken. And when we're activated into this process of ambiguous grief, we have all sorts of emotions and feelings. And, you know, something that's unique to ambiguous grievers, we found, was the experience of hope. And that is kind of a, you know, probably the key point to ambiguous grief, the ambiguous grief process as we found it, is that when our loved ones die a physical death, we're not hoping that they come back to us. We're not really hoping for that, right? We can long for it, but it's not a realistic hope that we hold. But if we're, you know, grieving our husband to incarceration or our child to addiction or our mother to Alzheimer's or our husband to divorce, we can hope that, you know, they diagnosis is found or they overcome their addiction or they're released early, or, you know, we can hope that they're ringing the doorbell. And that's a slippery slope.
Yes, absolutely. Something I actually haven't talked about on the podcast at all is that my husband was an alcoholic and also self-medicated with prescription drugs. And because he had chronic PTSD. And the first feeling that I had when I heard about his accident was a little bit of relief, because there was worry that I held on to. There was optimism. There was hope that he would just choose to get better, that things would change. And so I truly understand this. And there was an element of relief after his accident, because it was a very clear moment where this is how it is. And now I get to heal and process and adjust accordingly. Wow. And before that, it was very cyclical and tumultuous. And, you know, it was like a roller coaster ride, especially with PTSD, because you would have moments where you clearly see this person as they are, you know, to the depths of their soul, and you just want to enjoy and appreciate and get as many of those moments as possible. And then the PTSD spiral kind of starts, and it either goes deeper than it was, or they get to a certain point and they kind of snap. It's not like a snap out of it, but they recognize what's going on and they start doing the things to come out of it. And so you are on that ride. And when things are really good, they're really great, but it's almost like waiting for the shoe to drop a little bit. And then when they get to the, you know, depth, you're like, okay, but it's going to get better. But it's going to get better. Okay. Go back to that. So I completely understand. And I love that there's a term for this. I also, this really makes me think of, I feel very fortunate in that I met my husband after he did his 3 tours in Iraq. Though I got glimpses of who he was before he went to war, I know that the man who went to war was very, very different than the man who came back. And I would imagine this term of ambiguous grief would make a lot of sense to military spouses who sent one man off to war and received a very, very different one coming home.
I think you're right. And first, let me just say thank you, Lori, for sharing that about your husband. I think that really serves to honor his memory, because it's the truth. And the reason I couldn't find anybody to talk to about my experience willing to say that they had a similar experience is because shame and embarrassment attach themselves. We can internalize shame and embarrassment and not want anybody to know. And somebody asked me why I think that is at one point. And, you know, I think that we don't talk about it because we don't want to be talked about. Right. And so, it's such a disservice, because if we do that, then we're alone. But to shine a light on it and claim it as truth and say and speak our truth is just such a gift, not only to ourselves and our own integrity and that of our relationship, but to others who, you know, might be listening to you right now and say, oh my goodness, me too. Oh, okay. Yes. And they thought they were just alone and isolated. So just when the two of you are just such a beautiful example of this, when we have just one other person who understands, it can be all we need to begin healing. And And so, you know, in talking to families who are just in anguish because their child or their spouse or their sibling, you know, is struggling with substance abuse or behavioral abuse. Addiction comes in many forms, and we don't talk about our feelings. We don't, you know, we're not given permission oftentimes to feel. And, you know, our veterans and our soldiers, my word, right? Who needs it more? And my dad served as he's a veteran of the Vietnam War. Very proud of my dad. And, you know, we're getting better, but it's still not where it needs to be, right? In that kind of support. And so if we're not talking about our feelings, then we're going to look to numb our feelings. If we feel like we are strange or odd or something's wrong with us and we don't talk about it, we don't express that, we don't name it, then we're going to numb it. And that's where addiction can be activated with alcohol, pain medication, drugs, gambling, sex, work, exercise, eating, right? There's shopping. There's so many ways we can numb. And so I'm a big proponent of, as I know you are, of succumbing. Just here it comes. Let me feel it. Let me honor it. Even if I'm so over it and annoyed with it. Oh, here it is. Okay. I know what to do.
So why do you think we're so trapped in this? I'm afraid to acknowledge it. I mean, I think there are certain relationships that we have. Like my mom is in a memory situation. I've got a couple girlfriends that their mothers are in memory situations as well, and in varying levels. And I'm listening to you talk through this, and I really, really appreciate it. And I would echo what Lori says, that, you know, to have some words around it to kind of categorize it, I think helps a lot. But for me, I'm trying to figure out, like, why is it takes us so long to find, like, Lori and I kind, she was like 3 years in, I was 6 years in. And in your experience, why does it take us so long to just kind of say, I'm not the only one that's experienced this, right? I mean, there are so many people that have gone before me that this has happened. So why do we put this guilt on ourselves? Why do we say, oh my gosh, I got to be the only person? And I've done it, you know, I've done it too. I've done it a lot around a lot of things. And so why do you think, or what does your research say? Like, why do we wait so long? So it's such the relief once once you're like, hey, those are my tribe. There's my people. They understand me. I'm so like, ah! And it's just this huge weight that just comes off and you're like, okay, they got me. They understand me. I'm moving forward now.
Yes. My people. Right. So yeah. In my experience, and this is kind of my armchair analysis, right? This is my observation. There's absolutely no, I have not worked on any data to capture this that might speak otherwise to it, but I think it's cultural. I think it's societal. And yeah. If we think for a moment about how our parents' generation might have handled this, how were we taught about our grief? How are we taught about our personal experiences? So it's kind of a two-part answer. So the first part would be, let's look at what we learned in our families and our communities. And were you in a household that said, this is family business? Were you in a mm-hmm. household that says, we do not air our dirty laundry? You know, it's appearances, family that survived, you know, by putting on a face out in the community, but totally different behind closed doors, you know, or was it a family that spoke openly and honestly? You know, when I started my grief, when grief activated for me, which was, you know, as soon as the shock wore off, I had a stunning relative say, it stunned me when a relative said, you have to stop crying. Only cry in the shower. If you're going to cry, you only cry in the shower. You give yourself that. And I wrote an essay about why I don't cry in the shower. That's the title. And posted it online some months later. And I, you know, for me, and again, this is for me. For me, I had three children in my home, you know, who were in elementary and middle school at the time. And it felt inauthentic. If they didn't see me cry, what were they not having permission to do? If they didn't see me cry, they weren't seeing the depth of my loss. You know, this, it just didn't resonate with me. And so I think that, so to part one of your answer, to answer that, Trish, is that I think part of it is how we're raised and what we believe. And then secondly, oh my goodness, I think that we have become a society afraid of grief. And so I kind of say, you know, if we think about grief as we best know it, which is grief by physical death, we're even sterilizing the grief process by physical death that we already don't do well. And you spoke to that earlier about support that could be offered, right, to families. But, you know, when we were kids, when I was a kid anyhow, I would see hearses around town. And we all knew what a hearse was, right? And today, you don't see them anymore. And this was a curious phenomenon that I heard David Kessler speak about. Hearses are uncomfortable. People don't like to be out for a walk or enjoying their latte at the park and see a hearse go by. It's uncomfortable. So now, you know, you might see a procession in a hearse to a burial site, but we don't see hearses as we used to. They're now cargo vans that are taking our loved ones' bodies to and from. We don't hold ceremony in our homes the way we did just 100 years ago, where our communities would come into our home, where, you know, we didn't call the funeral services right away, you know, to come and take the body of our loved one. We did death differently. And in cultures all over the world, they do death differently. And so I think that it's so hard for us to reach out and find our people because of those two things, we don't necessarily have role models. We don't know how. We don't know who. And when you add social media into all of it, we do not celebrate our endings, right? I dare anybody to go on social media and count the celebration, right? Today's National Something Day, right? And there will be all sorts of posts about that. And there will also be wonderful uplifting posts that I love to see. And I'm sure the two of you do as well, where it's, oh, look who's engaged. Look who's expecting. Look who got that new job. Look at their new home. And there's celebrations for, oh, look at the giant scissors and the ribbon cutting. And, oh, they're married. And we see all these beautiful celebrations that come with ceremony and ritual. But when there's a divorce or a miscarriage or a diagnosis or that business goes under, we don't post our endings. We don't say it didn't end as we thought it, as we hoped it would. It didn't end as we wanted it to. So we have all these beautiful posts of our wonderful lives, but we don't post about our endings. And we certainly aren't as open in posting about what grief really looks like.
Yeah, my brain actually went all kinds of places when you were just talking, because I would argue that there are many beginnings of life that we are no longer, you know, the ceremony that they used to be. My mom bought the whole series of Virgin River
novels, which are, I mean, it's kind of like trashy romance novels, but I can't.
Okay.
But something that in these novels is that the women have like home births and people gather at the home when the baby's born. And I think this moment that life is brought into the world is not what it used to be either. It's become very sterile. It needs to be on some level, but it's also, you know, become something that's done behind closed doors, right?
Right.
Not necessarily talked about what happens behind those closed doors. And then, like you said, miscarriage, even though people are starting to talk about this, there is still so much that's not talked about from women who I know who are willing to share so many other stories. Miscarriage is something that they just can't get to. And I know I have one friend in particular who, you know, I became a certified grief coach, just hit the 1 year anniversary of her miscarriage. I talked about doing a ceremony and she's like, well, it's not really grief. And, you know, and this is a woman who shares, I mean, she has a podcast. She's amazing. She shares all of these things. And, you know, we had that conversation. And for me, it was more a realization that this just hasn't really fully been processed yet. Right. Because if I say it's grief, then it's real.
Right. And
but
it's
okay. Don't you think it's so? I mean, why do we? I mean, that validates her in so many ways. If you say, you know, you lost your baby. I mean, that was a part of you. I mean, the living individual. I mean, how do you just go, but that's been our culture for a lot of many, many, many years, is just sweep that under the rug like it never happened. And I feel like in our social media culture, everything has to be, it's everything's scrubbed to perfection. Everything has to be perfect. And life is not perfect. And Lori and I've talked about this before, that so much of who you become is because of the challenges and the swords you've had to die on. Are those, that's who you are. It's when my son is from Guatemala and they say that the scars that you have are the story you tell of your life, literally, like, you know, like physical stories, but there's mental and there's the physical and the mental scars. And that's why kind of what gives you that wisdom of that old sage, of the person that really can offer you advice. And so it saddens me a lot, and to know that we can't talk through things. And I think the reason it saddens me so much is because when people would ask me about my husband's passing, and this was, you know, it's been a while now, I don't know why, but it was my healing, that I would just be like, yeah, so this is how it went down. And I went through the detail. I went like, you know, I was in the hospital. This is a couple of days leading up to it. This is where we are. And, you know, there's, I think because I wasn't like sobbing while I was saying it, I mean, don't get me wrong, there were a few times I was sobbing while I was saying it, but as time passed, I felt as if I needed that to heal. So if it made them feel uncomfortable, you know, if they really asked, they were really going to get it. And so that's the path that I chose. I didn't do it all the time, but if they asked, I said, so, you know, I think for me, Stephanie, with you, you've got so much wonderful research to, you know, kind of substantiate how people feel and how our society looks at it. The one question I was kind of going to go back to, and I think this is a really interesting one, is about, you said hope is triggered. And so this hope is triggered. I think hope is triggered for a lot of people because they're hoping for something better. They're hoping it goes back to the way it was. I mean, hell, I just did this, I don't know, probably a couple of days ago. Gosh, I really hope, I wish, you know, he was around so we could do these fun things that we did in the fall. And or anytime out in the yard, right, whatever. And, but I think what's, but he's gone, right? So in my head, I can go, he's gone. I can't do that. But for these ambiguous relationships, you can't put it in a box. You can't say, this is what's happened. They're gone. So I've got to move on, like to what Lori said. So how do you keep that hope kind of in check? That was a long question to, how do you keep it in check? Because if somebody kidnapped, right, you're always hopeful. There's their drug addiction. You're like, oh, especially as a mother. I know I'm going to pray. And all of a sudden it's going to go away. And then all of a sudden they're dead because they've committed suicide or, you know, they've overdosed. We're living with cancer. I'm in the oncology space. And so there's so many people who are like, okay, we're just going to have this one more chemo. We're going to have this one more radiation and we're going to be well, and we're going to go back to the life that we lived. So I guess that is my question. How do you keep that hope in check? Can you keep it in check? If you keep it too much in check, do you live? If you don't keep it in check, you just circle the drain because you never see there's opportunity. And
love it.
So I'm just like,
yes. Great question. Thank you for asking this, because I think this is so important. And for me, it was wildly helpful to get my head around this. And, you know, we can't really interact with grief and embrace grief if we're trying to intellectualize it too much, right? We've got to feel it. We've got to, it's mind body, it's physiological. And yet this component of grieving, this ambiguous grief process is important, because hope is so different here. So, before I fully answer that for you, I do want to say, I am not a hater of hope. A little bit of a disclaimer. I'm really not. Hope is a virtue. We need hope in our life always, right? And yet everything we know about hope is beautiful and wonderful and warm and fuzzy, right? And there's so much wonderful poetry and essays written about hope. Pope Francis gives a beautiful TED Talk about hope. Emily Dickinson, probably her most famous poem is, "Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all." Wow, that is, we need that hope on our soul. And when every time I hear that or recite it, I think of just like a Cinderella's bluebird, you know, just perching away and tweeting away. But I have found that in the case of ambiguous grief, hope is a double agent. And hope, when misdirected, is as dangerous as it is good. And for ambiguous grievers, you know, there are hope. So hope emerges a lot, you know. So one day it's, if we were to take the Kubler-Ross model with all those emotions that we may or may not experience, anger, bargaining, depression, denial, acceptance, and now meaning, I experienced all of those, and they come as they wish in any form and stay for any length of time. And we all know they're nonlinear. And then there's other emotions and feelings too, right? And what I kept noticing in myself was something I couldn't name, but I would feel it. I would be able to say, oh, here's anger. Oh, now I'm bargaining. And then there was this something I couldn't name. And then that group of women that I talked about, my people, I would see it in them too. And I'm like, what is that? What is that? And then once I identified it, I identified it as hope. And that's when I started the partnering with Dr. Sophia Caudill, who I had seen for therapy, and we were no longer working together as patient, as I was no longer her patient. And but I had shared this hypothesis with her while I was her patient. And then after we started, after that relationship stopped, we reconnected and started to put together this survey to see just how many people were going through this in the way we suspected. And what we found was that in addition to all those other feelings, sure enough, there's hope. People were experiencing hope. And it's like that old whack-a-mole game at the arcade where, you know, it comes up and that's hope, you know, just got to pound it down. Because to your point, circling the drain, it's just brilliant that you would use that term, Trish, because that's exactly what happens. And I write about it and talk about the roundabout, because hope presents, but it's internal hope where we're hoping for ourselves. Like, I'm going to be okay today. Today, I'm going to walk the dog and do the dishes. And you know what? There's a whole new world in front of me today. And there's the bluebird, right? Like, oh, it's lovely. It's beautiful. And then it could be external hope. Okay, I'm going to just roll up my sleeves here. And I'm going to find an AA program. Let me see if I can get some information on, you know, research for Alzheimer's. Who's the best? What, you know, what drugs are in trial? I'm going to call a lawyer and get this, you know, sentence reduced. We go into external hope where we start problem solving. We start directing our energy towards something that is outside of ourselves and is connected to our person, because we're trying to restore that relationship. We're trying to restore it. And even though we know it may not be exactly as it once was, we still want it. We still want that relationship back because it's comfort. We know it. We recognize it. We want it back. And so in that case, it's not the bluebird. It's more Iago, that squawking parrot from The Lion King that's just so annoying and doesn't shut up. And it's kind of counterintuitive, right? Because external hope feels good. It's counterintuitive because we don't know that we're in external hope unless we have the language for it, I think. Because it feels so good because you're being active, you're taking action to restore your relationship. You're taking action for the person you love to help them kick that addiction or reconcile. Whatever you're trying to do, your energy is directed toward them, which isn't something you're going to do if your loved one has died a physical death, right? And internal hope. So that's the external hope, feels good, which is why it's dangerous. And if we stay in external hope too long, we can slide into complicated grief or, you know, the grief where we are really defining ourself, our identity, our life by our loss. And, you know, you said circling the drain, but we can go in between. We can do the roundabout of external hope and internal hope, external hope and internal hope. And I call it cycling. And so, you know, some days I'm internal hope and I'm reimagining my life for me. And some days it's external hope. And the more we practice identifying our behaviors, we can stop it and say, oh, whoa, wait a minute. I just slipped back into external hope. Let me acknowledge that and let me refocus my energy internally. Let me focus on hope for my future. And it's scary and it doesn't feel good. And that's what makes it counterintuitive, because we want to calm and ease and comfort ourselves in our grief. And so we want to do what feels good, but it's not good for us. And so the more we can practice internal hope and traveling that path, the more we move toward what we call recovery, which isn't my favorite word, but is, you know, kind of paints the picture of a place we're headed.
I keep having this image, because think about how difficult this is for adults. And then, of course, me, my brain moves toward children, like the children of teens and children. And to be very frank, some of my relief after my husband died was that my children were never going to experience what a lot of my students had, where you hear birthday is coming up and, you know, the parent who has addiction, the parent who kind of comes and goes, has set up, you know, some sort of surprise. They're going to spend the day together. There's all of this hope and wonder, and it's going to be different this time. And then now they sit outside on the porch for 4 hours, you know. And at the time of my husband's accident, he was not well at all, in that it was becoming very apparent to me that he probably wasn't going to choose to get better. And I kind of had that really jaded vision for my children. And it was very scary. And so there was a relief that, well, this is done. This is the end. It's going to affect them their entire lives, but they won't have those, like you said, going around the roundabout experiences that, you know, are difficult for adults to handle, but truly kind of start shaping the identity of children and teens as they're, you know, there's so much that they're learning anyway, like figuring out that they really internalize and take on as part of who they are. So I'm curious as to, you know, your thoughts, or, you know, what you have in terms of how the ambiguous grief really kind of affects the children in these situations. Mm-hmm.
You know, just, I'll tell you, I've never been asked that question. And, but I have an answer because I've talked it through with my person. And, you know, I think the short answer is we are only as sick as our secrets. And so to be as honest as we can with our children in an appropriate, in an age-appropriate way is the short answer. And if you know, a parent is listening and their child is out on the porch on hour number two waiting for whatever's not coming, then, you know, when they validate that, when they come in and they're disappointed, validate that. How are you feeling? You look like you might be disappointed in so-and-so. Is that how you're feeling? Can you tell me how you're feeling? You know, and to try to talk to the child about it, you know, for teenagers, as, you know, as our children get older, and of course, always depending on the age, I think, especially when it's related to addiction, I'm just a big proponent of the truth. And, you know, mom or dad or grandpa, grandma, whoever has disappointed them, to be able to share openly and honestly, yeah, I know that's got to be really disappointing. And, you know, remember, that's kind of what we talked about. That's something that happens for people often who are battling substance abuse, or this is something that mom or dad or grandma or grandpa, you know, does sometimes. And it's not because they don't love you. It's because their brain is wired differently because of the addiction. And of course, you know, again, just mentioning teenagers, helping teenagers understand that part of their, you know, science is telling us that part of addiction can be something that's passed down, right? It's, if it's hereditary, if it's in the family, if you have, you know, a heart disease in your family, if you have diabetes in your family, if you have anything that's hereditary, we're going to inform our children, right? So that they can advocate for their best health too. Why wouldn't we tell our children that there's also a history of addictive behavior in our family, or, you know, addiction to substance, without shame and embarrassment? If we don't talk about it, then they're going to connect the dots and assume they're going to make up the story. We're just going to make up a story because we're wired to try to understand and we'll fill in the blanks. And that's dangerous. We don't need kids assuming the worst or thinking less than, you know, and this life is filled with so many opportunities to experience joy and experience pain and experience love and experience grief. And they are yin and yang. They are one with, we can't have one without the other. And so I think the best we can do is to equip our kids and model for them with honesty. You know, this was something that happened when, you know, dad was fighting in a war, really scary, and the way the nervous system works and the way our brains are wired, his wiring became a little different. And so, yeah, sometimes he doesn't remember to show up when he said he would. I know it's disappointing. And also, you need to be careful when you decide to experiment with alcohol because you may have a propensity. So let's talk about that too.
I have a question, Lori, and I've talked about this too, is that what if, so you're that parent, right? That's left while the other one has an addiction or they have other issues. And so you're the parent that's overcompensating. So what has been your experience with that? And what have you found? Because in all these situations, I believe that the parent that isn't the one that has this loss, I mean, they have the loss, but they're not the one actually addicted or PTSD or whatever the case may be. What has been your experience or your advice for those people that do overcompensate with or the guilt that comes with that? It's usually overcompensation because of guilt. What do you say to that?
You know, I feel, and I say this again out of my own experience, just I'll speak honestly firsthand, is that, you know, the reaction, the response of overcompensation, right? You said it. It comes from fear. It comes from guilt. It comes from guilt. And if we peel away all of our feelings and get really intimate with understanding what we're feeling and what it is, it's so interesting how we can excavate and excavate and excavate, and what we are left with are the two common denominators of fear and love, right? And so ultimately, are we acting out of fear or are we acting out of love? And for a parent, for me and many parents I know, it's hard to own that and say, yeah, okay, I'm acting out of fear. You know, Gary Zukav calls it a scared part of our personality. And when we're acting out of that part of our personality, it's not because we're not brave or we're a coward or we're weak. It's because we love our children and we want to protect them. But that's our job to a point. Right. And that's something that I had to arrive at, is I don't want to take hard life experiences away from my kids, because then they won't be functional adults. If we did that for our children, if our parents did that for us, we'd still be living with them, wouldn't we? And that's not the natural order. You know, if I identify as a parent whose role is to love my children and help to raise them into adulthood, then I have to recognize that my behavior, and again, being able to get quiet is key to be able to identify and reflect and name my own behavior. Yuck, it's so hard. And say, oh, look what I just did. I'm overcompensating. And ultimately, that's going to be more times detrimental to the child than good, right? Why are we protecting them from this? And it's hard to see our children in pain. It's hard to see them hurting and grieving. And yet, how lucky are we that they do this while under our roof, that we are able to guide them through this hard stuff. We can model it for them and we can validate them. And a lot of times the kids don't need, you know, a trip to Rome or that another new fill in the blank, you know, oh, more video games. Oh, let's hop on an order. Let's buy. Let's, you know, they don't need that. They need validation in that. Yes, this stinks. This is awful. This hurts. How can we name that and helpfully manage it? There's a button. I just sent this to a friend yesterday who is going through grief, she and her daughter. And there's a button you can buy, you know, like the button you press and it says yes or no. This button says the F word in 10 different ways. And do you know how funny kids think that is? It's right. It's so wildly inappropriate, but to acknowledge to a child, you use this in your room behind closed doors when you need to. Don't share it with your friends, please. Don't need any parents calling me. You use this however you need it. And for mothers or that whoever might be overcompensating, I personally recommend the shut up button for all of the ridiculous advice we're getting on how to go through what we're going through. Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you. Oh, okay. Shut up. Right. Just feels better. Like there's ways we can help our kids feel it. And
I love both of those buttons. I think I might have to purchase them. So what I really like about what you're saying is, but I think before you can do the things that you're saying, is you have to have that certain amount of awareness about yourself, right? Because I think that's been one of the biggest things that I've had to get to is realize, oh, that's my fear showing now. Oh, I'm angry because I'm actually fearful. And it comes out maybe as anger. And then once you realize what your feelings are, then you can kind of out of body experience, then coach your kids on it. But if you don't realize what you're feeling first, there's no, and so it really is so important about healing yourself and healing your, how you feel and getting that support system there to help, because you, otherwise this crazy trend can become more and more generational, as you alluded to.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And it all comes back to, you know, again, naming our emotions and feeling it and what is sitting in it? What is this? I don't even know what, you know, and being able to name it. There's a great poster for kids and adults with, you know, 100 different emotions on it. And then there's the Plutchik's color wheel, right? Which shows that, you know, this plus this equals this. And when we can really get to know ourselves, we can know what activates these responses in us. We can know how to tame them. We can know what helps to comfort us, or, you know, what makes us feel worse. I personally find comfort in salt and vinegar chips, which, you know, isn't necessarily the most healthy option, but apples just don't comfort me in the same way. And so I know that if I'm like craving my salt and vinegar chips, then I probably need to do some journaling. I probably need to go grab my button. I need to work through an emotion. And that's only because I figured that out. Do you know how long I've been eating these chips? We can look at our own behaviors. Yeah.
My 7-year-old would love the F word button. I also believe he's going to create those kind of things when he is an adult. And mine is white cheddar popcorn. Always has been. Always will be. I feel like I could talk to you all day. Like,
likewise.
But I do want to give you an opportunity to give your final thoughts.
Gosh, well, thanks for the conversation. I really enjoyed chatting with both of you. And I would just encourage anybody listening who's going through a grief of any kind to honor it in a healthy way and reach out and find support with a certified grief coach or trusted friend or somebody who speaks your language, somebody who understands. And if you're not sure if they speak your language, they don't. Because when somebody speaks your language, you know it. You say, oh, they get it. Okay. And, you know, pursue that. And if you're going through the experience of grieving the loss of a loved one who is still living, though not as they once were, know that you're not alone. There is healing. There is hope. There are proactive exercises and tools you can use to get through it. And, you know, I found my way thanks to trusted friend and solid therapy and so many books and following my own intuition, following my own punches. And mine is certainly not the only way to travel this path, but I've written a book. It's called Soul Broken, a guidebook for your journey through ambiguous grief. And it's published by Balance, an imprint of Grand Central Publishing. And it's out on October 11th. And my hope is that the book will help others feel less alone, as I did 6 years ago. And my deep hope is that if they do read the book and feel less alone, that they in turn will help somebody else feel less alone too. And I think the more that we can talk about our grief openly and honestly, without shame, without embarrassment, but instead with the love that grief is born from, we can help each other along the path as we go. And why wouldn't we want to?
That was beautiful. Thank you so much. And thanks for talking with us today. I loved it.
Thanks so much.